The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral W. Pease presiding. All of our business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, I'm Judge Peach. To my right is Judge Bartley. To my left is Judge Meredith. We are here today in the matter of Del Rio versus Wilkie, docket number 17-4220. The issue before the court is whether the grant of a total disability rating based on individual unemployability may be based on symptoms which have been found to be service-connected, but for which disability benefits were not in effect during the period for which a total disability rating is sought. Would the counsel for both parties please note their appearance for the court and for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. Elise Galaski of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick for the appellant, Mr. Justiniano Del Rio, and with me at counsel's table is Amy Odom, also of the firm.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Brandon Callahan for the secretary. With me at counsel's table is Deputy Chief Counsel James Cowan.
Thank you. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments, and counsel for the appellate, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes. 10 minutes, please.
10 minutes, okay, thank you. Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Mr. Del Rio has been diagnosed with both fibromyalgia and PTSD for the entire period on appeal. But because he was not service-connected for his fibromyalgia, prior to October 2006, the board in its adjudication of TDIU did not consider his fibromyalgia symptoms for the pre-2006 period. However, under Section 4.16, the board must consider the impact of all disabilities that are service-connected on the date of the TDIU adjudication. This is consistent with cases such as Rice, Van Hoos, and Hattelstead, which all say that the board, upon adjudication of TDIU, must consider all service-connected disabilities. However, what this court has not yet answered is which service-connected disabilities are actually included in that assessment. If it includes disabilities that were service-connected throughout the entire time on appeal, or if it includes all service-connected disabilities as of the date of the adjudication of the TDIU. This court's recent case in Frost helps us answer that question.
Before you go any further, let me just, if you don't mind, I'd like to clarify something. Mr. Del Rio was granted TDIU benefits effective October 2006?
Correct.
And what date does Mr. Del Rio want an effective date for TDIU earlier than 2006?
It could go back to as early as September 1999. That's the effective date of his PTSD claim, which has been active and was active when he first raised the TDIU issue.
And at that time, what was he rated at percentage-wise for PTSD in 1999?
One moment, Your Honor. He was granted a 10% rating effective 1999. I apologize for that, Your Honor.
No problem. So 10% in 1999.
Correct.
And Mr. Del Rio is proposing that he be provided an effective date of as early as 1999 because of the 10% PTSD, percentage for PTSD.
Yes, Your Honor. This court's holding in Frost has established that, or has given us some knowledge about this question. In Frost, that the court held that, in Frost, the court looked at 3.31 and held that it did not contain a temporal requirement. The statute in 4.16 is similar to that in that there is also not a temporal requirement in that case. In that case, they determined that the relationship between a secondary and a primary condition for secondary service connection purposes should be assessed at the date of the decision. The same is true with TDIU. The relationship between underlying conditions and a person's ability to work should be determined at the date of the TDIU adjudication.
Does the fact that I see the connection you're trying to draw between the analysis of, in Frost of 3.310 and the 4.16 reg, but 4.16 is in Part 4. And although 4.16 doesn't contain a temporal requirement specifically, Part 4 has a base temporal requirement in that it's talking about rating disabilities that are service-connected, right? So why wouldn't that suffice to create a temporal requirement for 4.16?
Because TDIU is a unique type of rating, 4.16 says that you should look at all of the service-connected disabilities on an individual's ability to work. Rice has made it clear that TDIU is different than a normal condition that's rated under the rating criteria. It really looks at a unique, individualized perspective of someone's ability to work. And the only guidance we have is that you should look at all service-connected disabilities. We also have some guidance with the fact that the language includes the word rateable as opposed to the word rated. The Federal Circuit has defined the word rateable as something that's being capable of rated or something that's capable of being evaluated. And within Part 4 of Title 38, that rateable word comes up. And every time that it comes up, it's not used to define something that's service-connected. It's used to define something that could potentially be service-connected. So the same would be here today. It would be that 4.16 has a possibility of being rated, not necessarily something that's already been service-connected.
Well, how would your analysis then apply if you had a single disability as the basis for TDIU? Are you saying that you could get TDIU prior to the date that the, let's say we're talking about him and he's trying to get service connection, he's trying to get TDIU based on PTSD alone.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the effective date of PTSD is 1996. He's establishing TDIU and VA is trying to figure out the effective date. Could he go prior to the 1996 date?
No, he could not. So his established effective date in this case is 1999 because of his PTSD. That is going to allow him to bring on other service-connected disabilities back to that time period. But if he only had the PTSD, he couldn't make it earlier than that effective date. It's just whether you can look at the symptoms of other later service-connected disabilities after 1999.
Yeah, but your analysis about the term rateable and what it normally means, I mean, that seemingly could apply to the PTSD that the veteran, let's say he had symptoms prior to the effective date of service connection.
I think there has to be a line that you would draw, and it would have to go back to the original effective date. And it does matter that there's more than one condition as well, because really what we're looking at is whether all of the service-connected conditions are being viewed within the time period that TDIU was originally, or as far back as TDIU could go. Because there, you know, the requirements of actually filing for a claim still exist. It's just extending it to other service-connected disabilities.
I just wanted to clarify, do you think it's 4.16A that's relevant here or 4.16B? So the language you're talking about, the ratable, appears in A.
Correct. So the ratable language appears in A. I do think it would probably apply to both, just because it has to do with, you know, whether they're reaching a certain level. But A is where that ratable language comes from.
But you're seeking an extra scheduler rating for the period from 1999 to 2006? Extra scheduler TDIU?
Correct. Yes. I think it also helps to look at it this way, as TDIU is really a two-part adjudication. It's first a procedural adjudication. We get a lot of that from Rice. Rice tells us when a TDIU claim becomes part and parcel to another claim, or when to adjudicate it, whether to adjudicate it as an increased rating claim or as part of an initial claim for benefits. But there's also a substantive element after you get past that procedural element, where you must look at what disabilities are being rated. So the first part, and I think this goes to your question previously, Judge Bartley, is the procedural. How far back can we actually look at TDIU? When is the effective date? The second part is, what are we actually looking at when we are adjudicating TDIU? And based on the plain language of 4.16, it says all ratable disabilities, all ratable service-connected disabilities. Because there's no temporal requirement, and based on this court's guidance from Frost, the reading of that would be all service-connected disabilities at the time of the adjudication, at the time of the TDIU adjudication. In this case, Mr. Del Rio was service-connected for both his fibromyalgia and his PTSD at the time of his TDIU adjudications. So all of those symptoms should have been considered.
And so the fact that 4.16 talks about total disability ratings for compensation purposes, and that they may be assigned. So it doesn't matter that he doesn't have he's not getting compensation for the fibromyalgia yet. I'm just not getting how you're working with that, how your interpretation fits within that language. Mm-hmm.
I think it helps to look at TDIU, our entitlement to TDIU, and an entitlement to a rating for a specific disability as two unique avenues to get benefits. So with a rating schedule, we're not looking for the court to apply his symptoms of fibromyalgia to the rating schedule to grant him an increased rating for his fibromyalgia. We're asking the court to have the board look at his symptoms based on all of his service-connected disabilities for the TDIU under that individualized perspective, which, you know, would, because there's no temporal requirement, involve the fibromyalgia. I think if we could put a hypothetical to it, say Mr. Del Rio was actually service-connected for his fibromyalgia in 1999, but he never appealed that decision, that initial rating. Today, during this TDIU appeal, we couldn't now ask this court to affect that original 1999 rating, but because it was service-connected, it would still be part of the TDIU analysis, because it's service-connected at the date of the decision. The same is true here. It's service-connected at the date of the decision, so we're not asking the court to affect his fibromyalgia rating. We're asking the court to have the board include those symptoms within the adjudication. The other thing I think that is important to note about this case is that Mr. Del Rio has had a diagnosis for fibromyalgia since 1991. So this wouldn't apply to cases where a veteran didn't have a ratable disability for the entire period on appeal. Here it makes sense because he's had that diagnosis since 1991, and since then, in service, he presented with pain in his shoulders, which he didn't exactly know the cause of, but was assessed with fibromyalgia. Later, after service, a doctor noted that his pain in his shoulders was related to his fibromyalgia. Then a VA examination noted that he was unable to work as a result, at least in part, to his fibromyalgia, and has not worked since 1996. And the board has has also conceded that the veteran's unable to work because of his TDIU, because of his PTSD and his fibromyalgia.
On that note, I noticed a little loose end in the record, and that is he had a claim for joint pain and muscle pain back in 1996, and it looks like he filed an NOD. Did he just not file a substantive appeal as to that? Because
correct.
He just did. He didn't.
Okay. Yeah, his substantive appeal was only to his PTSD specifically. So that's why his claim didn't go on past that point for his fibromyalgia or for the joint pain. Correct. But if we look at this as a broader, as it would apply to all veterans, and as this court noted in Frost, there are many instances where a veteran may not be aware of a disability until later on. In Frost, it was that the veteran was not aware that he had an underlying disability that caused, you know, a secondary disability. And this is the same type of logic. A veteran may not necessarily be aware that his joint pain is related to that fibromyalgia diagnosis that he had in service. He may not be aware that his fibromyalgia is preventing him from working, or even, frankly, that he is prevented from substantially gainful employment until much later on in the record. So applying those same concerns in Frost, it makes sense to interpret 4.16 this way. In this pro-veteran paternalistic system, veterans shouldn't be penalized for not understanding the vocational and legal intricacies of the system, especially in this case where Mr. Del Rio did have a diagnosis since 1991, and the board has conceded that his fibromyalgia and PTSD together prevent him from working, that he hasn't worked since 1996.
Well,
go ahead. I was going to move on. Okay, just one more one question on that point. Mr. Del Rio was diagnosed with fibromyalgia in 1991. You're not saying you want to go back to 1991. Okay,
no.
You want to go back to 1999. Had Mr. Del Rio been diagnosed with some other ailment, what I'm trying to get at is, are you saying that every ailment that they have should be presented in an extra scheduler determination?
No, I think what the board or what the adjudicator should be doing is looking at the code sheet, looking at the most recent service-connected disabilities and determining what is service-connected. Once you look at what's service-connected, at that point you're looking at how those conditions are affecting him and since when. So it's not every ailment he ever had, but it's the service-connected conditions. Based on 4.16, they should be looking at all the service-connected conditions.
Again, and then so service connection was for fibromyalgia 2006, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
So what would be the point of establishing an effective date for fibromyalgia if you're not using it for anything? Like, it doesn't mean anything in this context. It's just like it's irrelevant what effective date they established for fibromyalgia under your TDIU analysis.
It's not irrelevant, and it of course would go to what his actual ratings were. It would go to whether he's under A or under B, and for what time period, and you know it goes to his combined ratings. As far as what you're looking at, what symptoms you're looking at, we do agree that his actual effective date shouldn't be considered solely for the purpose of, you know, considering the symptoms and for TDIU. But there are circumstances where it would matter. For example, if he first was adjudicated for TDIU prior to 2006, and there was a TDIU denial, they didn't consider fibromyalgia, we certainly wouldn't be challenging that because he wasn't service-connected prior to October 2006. So the effective date does, you know, it's not irrelevant, but we do think that they should be looking at symptoms prior to that effective date in this instance, because TDIU goes back to 1999.
Well, assuming that we disagree with you regarding the Frost non-temporality argument, what What are your other arguments? Can you talk to me about your other arguments? Like, what would we, let's assuming we reject that. Give me your best argument that we shouldn't just affirm the board decision.
We think that the plain language, and especially that the term ratable, goes to the fact, I don't want to bring up the temporal requirement, but.
Yeah, don't get into that. Now, you've had several other arguments in your brief.
Oh, I apologize. So not speaking about the fibromyalgia.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So, and actually, as was conceded by Secretary's counsel in his recent notice to the court, we do not believe that this board decision was in compliance with Ray v. Wilkie. So we do agree that remand is required at least for the board to issue a new decision with adequate reasons and basis based on that. We don't believe that they properly compared the veteran's symptoms to whether he could actually complete substantially gainful employment. And that would, if this court were to disagree that fibromyalgia should have been considered, we think that based on just his PTSD alone, the case should go back for the board to provide adequate reasons and basis and comply with the new decision of Ray v. Wilkie.
And you made some I think Ray wasn't out when you filed your brief, but you made some other arguments about the treatment of medical opinions and how the board, any of those that you want to talk to us about?
Sure. Well, we think that the board shouldn't just be adopting a medical opinion as a truth without properly exploring the contents of that opinion. We think that an examiner, if they must be competent to actually opine on vocational issues. A medical expert is not necessarily competent to opine on the actual vocational issues, whether somebody can actually find work in his job space based on his symptoms. We agree that a medical expert is certainly competent to opine to the extent of someone's disability, but it's the next step of applying that disability to whether someone can find a particular job in a particular workspace and actually complete what the board has started to define, or what the court rather has started to define in Ray as substantially gainful employment. At the very least, we think the board would be required to explain why they find a medical examiner competent to make such a determination.
I've added time so you can continue. You have 4 more minutes.
Thank you.
So you're saying that an expert, let's just say it's a plain old MD, could they provide any opinion as to the effect of a veteran's disability on their ability to work?
I think the answer is that it depends. It depends on what the opinion that they're providing is and what information they have. So if an expert has knowledge of, say, a veteran is currently working, and they have knowledge of what the veteran's symptoms are and how those symptoms affect their current workspace, I think that they could opine on it. It's when they're starting to estimate what's actually out there, what's actually in the workspace, something that they wouldn't know as somebody who's not a vocational expert. That's where we would have to draw a line.
So you would say that only a vocational expert can give an opinion on issues related to a veteran's ability to work?
I think it depends on what extent they're really opining on that. If they're starting to use terms like substantially gainful employment, if they're starting to use terms like sedentary work, terms that have their own definition within a vocational world, I think it would require some evidence that they're competent to make that kind of determination past just them opining on, you know, what strictly their symptoms are, how they interact with people.
And you made some arguments about the board's treatment of the 02, the 03, and 05 psych VAEs.
Yes.
Yeah, can you just go through that for me?
Okay. I think that any time that the board is looking at a VAE, they really should be also not just looking at the conclusion, but looking at the underlying findings and rationales of that VAE, because it's a very similar rationale. They shouldn't just be adopting the ultimate conclusion of any examiner or any expert. They really should be looking at what the substance is of those exams so that they can provide adequate reasons and basis so that they are doing an independent analysis of the evidence. So here we think that the board should have adequately considered the underlying findings and rationales of those examinations. Your Honors, for this reason, Mr. Del Rio seeks a rule that when adjudicating TDIU, VA must consider the impact of all conditions that are service-connected on the date of that adjudication, including those conditions not yet service-connected during the time period on appeal. We ask that this court remand this case for the board to re-examine the evidence based on that rule of law. And specifically, we ask that the board be required to consider the veteran's fibromyalgia prior to 2006 for TDIU purposes. At the very least, remand is required for the board to issue a decision in compliance with this court's recent decision in Ray v. Wilkie, as the secretary has conceded in his August 13, 2019 notice to the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Appellant has asked for the court's guidance on the question of the potential applicability of this court's holding in Frost versus Shulkin to his claim for TDIU. I'd like to just begin by expressing the secretary's agreement that the court's guidance on this subject would be helpful to the board upon remand. And with that said, I'd like to discuss the unworkable nature of appellant's argument. In having this discussion, I think it's important to have a clear understanding of exactly what appellant is asking this court to find. Appellant is asking for a holding that the board was required to consider the impact of his fibromyalgia on his ability to engage in substantially gainful employment prior to October 11, 2006. There's a fatal flaw with this argument, and I think that flaw comes out in this court's holding in Rice, where the court told us that TDIU is, quote, best analyzed as a claim for an increased disability rating. If TDIU is an increased disability compensation rating, then it must be related to a service-connected disability, or in the case of TDIU, a group of service-connected disabilities. So what appellant is really asking for is a finding that the board was required to consider the impact of a non-service-connected disability on his ability to engage in substantially gainful employment prior to October 11, 2006. That obviously can't stand because it's inconsistent with large swaths of this court's jurisprudence, including cases such as Dingus and Hartman, and it's inconsistent with 3.321's discussion of the assignment of compensation disability ratings. So the only other construction that can be presented to appellant's argument is that appellant is asking for an earlier effective date for his service connection of fibromyalgia, such that there could then be a service-connected disability to which the increased rating in the form of TDIU would be applied. The problem with this is that the question of the effective date for appellant's service connection of fibromyalgia was not within the board's jurisdiction. That question was settled in a rating decision from July 24, 2007, to which appellant did not provide a notice of disagreement and became final on July 31st, 2008. So that question was not within the board's jurisdiction and it's not within the court's jurisdiction. And so really under either construction, what appellant is asking this court to find would be a gigantic revolution in the law, which would require the court to overrule foundational cases such as Hattelstad, Van Hoos, Dingus, Rudd, Rice, and Rice, all while navigating the effective date requirements of 38 USC 5110 and 38 CFR 3.400. What this disconnect between these two constructions and the unworkable nature of either shows us is that there is an inherent temporal element in 4.16. I believe Judge Bartley's phrasing was a base temporal requirement. That is clearly at work in this case because otherwise appellant's argument would not have such tension within it. Appellant is attempting to analogize this case to the court's holding in Frost. However, just on a base level, Frost is a case dealing with an entirely different regulation that has entirely different language.
But even on a broader conceptual level, the concepts behind those regulations are entirely different. Frost dealt with the application of 3.310, which is secondary service connection. And secondary service connection is the discussion of the relation between two distinct disabilities to one another. This case deals with Regulation 4.16, which is the question of one disability or one group of disabilities to its own disability rating. Conceptually, that's very different. And so the Secretary's position is that Frost is largely inapplicable here, as it just discusses a different question. Appellant has attempted to bolster this argument through the discussion of the language rateable in 4.16a. I believe Judge Meredith's question is right on point. 4.16a is not applicable in this case, but to the extent that appellant is arguing that the language somehow sets a tone for subsection B, I would begin by saying that the Secretary has never discerned any practicable difference between the language rateable and the proposed language rated. That reading is bolstered by the language that both precedes and follows the rateable discussion in 4.16. Because 4.16a says that total disability ratings for compensation may be assigned, quote, where the scheduler rating is less than total. That language is not hypothetical, it's not conditional, it's talking about the actual scheduler disability rating that has been assigned. The regulation then goes on to discuss the disability. If there's a single disability, it should be rateable at 60%. If there are multiple disabilities, one should be rateable at 40%, quote, and sufficient additional disability to bring the combined rating to 70% or more. Again, that language isn't conditional, it isn't hypothetical, it's talking about the actual disability rating that's been assigned. So that really bolsters the Secretary's long-term reading that there is no difference here, but to the extent that there is any value in the language rateable, the Secretary largely agrees with the definition that Appellant's Counsel has proposed. I believe she said today that the Federal Circuit defined rateable as something capable of being rated. It appears that the rateable language in 4.16a is essentially setting a minimum. It's providing guidance to the adjudicators. It's an indication that the ratings don't have to be exactly 60% or exactly 40%, but can be higher than that, because by the law of lesser included numbers, if something is rateable at, say, 70%, rated, I should say, at 70%, it is also obviously capable of being rated at 60% or 40%. So really, it's providing additional guidance to the adjudicators. And I think it's important in considering this language to also remember that this language was drafted before Rice. And so Rice gives us the lens through which to view this language and to understand its role in the disability compensation scheme. And again, what Rice tells us is that TDIU is an increased rating claim. And if it's a rating, a disability compensation rating, I should say, it must be attached to a service-connected disability or a group of service-connected disabilities. And appellant, again, is asking for the board to consider whether or not this disability impacted his ability to engage in substantially gainful employment prior to the date of its service connection. Lastly, I would just note that to the extent that the court discerns any remaining ambiguity in the rateable language provided in 4.16a, the Secretary would ask that the court defer to his reasonable interpretation of the regulation consistent with the Supreme Court's guidance in Kaiser. With that said, So
let's move on from the Frost non-temporality argument. You did concede error based on Ray?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. I just wanted you to address a few reasons or bases arguments that the appellant made.
Certainly, Your Honor.
One was, so the board found that the 03 and 05 VAEs didn't say that he was unemployable.
Correct.
And they used that seemingly as evidence against finding TDIU.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that justifiable?
Well, I think that any discussion of the adequacy of the examinations or the board's use of the examinations is really bound up with the concession that or the agreement, I should say, from both parties that the case needs to go back for R&B consistent with Ray, because I think that Ray provided additional guidance in the line of the cases Flora, Frisha, and Moore about what exactly the examiners can provide. And I think in large respect, the Secretary would agree with Appellant's Counsel that the specific discussions provided by an examiner need to be very carefully scrutinized by the board to ensure that they're consistent with the guidance provided in Flora, Frisha, Moore, and now Ray, because the cases are all very clear that the examiners are able to speak to at the very least, a veteran's ability to perform, I believe the phrasing from Ray is, the physical and mental tasks associated with substantially gainful employment. So it seems there's very little question that the examiners can give that. And
but this seems to go to a broader issue than Floor or Gieb or any of those other cases address, and that is when an examiner is maybe talking about the veteran's work performance or ability to work, if they don't say as the 03 and 05 examiners did not say he is unable to obtain or maintain substantially gainful employment, can you use whatever else they say about his employment performance as evidence that he's not TDIU?
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, I think that the discussion in Ray, again, is kind of illuminating here, because Ray talks about, as I say, the mental and physical abilities required for substantially gainful employment. So to the extent that an examiner were examining a veteran and found that he was completely unable to perform any of those mental and physical tasks associated with substantially gainful employment, I don't think it would be out of bounds for the examiner to say that he's not able to engage in substantially gainful employment by virtue of the fact that he or she are not able to engage in any of those tasks, which again I think is really why this question is very much bound up with the Ray concession, because it really speaks to a need for the board to look at the particulars of each examination and exactly what the examiner said and their rationale for it, and determine if that's consistent with the guidance provided in the line that Your Honor and I have been discussing.
Okay, I'm going to try again.
I apologize if I'm...
to get you to agree that some of these issues are not bound up with Ray.
Okay.
let me try again. So on page 13 of the board decision, the board said that the April 96 examiner, I think this was the, might have been the Upjohn.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, some examiner that works for them assessed the veteran and found that he was unable to engage in stressful situations or engage in interpersonal relationships. And the board basically dismissed that seemingly favorable statement and said that that examiner didn't provide a rationale for that. Now, do you think that that statement needs a rationale?
Well, I think that...
There's...
I apologize.
The 496, the April 96
sure.
examiner's statement about this veteran can't develop interpersonal relationships, can't survive when, you know, stressful situations at work.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that I'm certainly not going to say that it should not have rationale or that it could not have rationale. Obviously, the board is the finder of fact and is entitled to weigh the probative value of the evidence. I think to the extent that the examiner is providing just conclusions that he is not able to engage in certain mental or physical abilities, I think that is something that could have rationale, certainly, because there's a question of how the examiner determined that, what the underlying testing was, what the examination yielded, how they reached this conclusion. I understand Your Honor's point, I hope, that the examiner seems to be providing a discussion of what his abilities are or aren't.
Right. The question is whether the examiner was providing an observation, a factual observation, about the veteran's abilities, or giving an opinion about the veteran's abilities.
Right, and I think that is something that, again, is best left to the board as the initial fact finder, because I think that question is really bound up in how the information is presented by the examiner and what the support provided in the rest of the report is, because rarely these reports are just this one statement. So again, I think that the discussion from the 96 examiner is something that certainly could require a statement of rationale to support it, and to the extent that the board, is owed some deference in its weighing of the probative evidence, of course the secretary would ask that the court not disturb that without a clear error, which I don't see here, but again, I think that this bleeds into a territory, not to violate the terms of the question, but I think this bleeds into a territory where there's going to be a further discussion from the board upon remand, because we need to determine what was consistent with the court's guidance in Ray, and the board needs to consider the claim consistent with the guidance in Ray and the way that that guidance interplays with Floor, Frischemore, Guybe, and the other cases.
Now, just to clarify, in your notice to the court, you conceded what?
We conceded that the claim is appropriately vacated, or I should say the decision is appropriately vacated and the claim is remanded for the board to provide a statement of reasons or bases consistent with the guidance in Ray and to conduct any additional development that may be necessary for them to be able to provide such a decision.
Okay, and so it's only on that argument that was proposed. They had three arguments. The appellant had three arguments. The Ray issue, the standard, the issue which is before us right now, which is the considering the fibromyalgia symptoms, and the third argument they say is that the secretary failed to consider favorable and relevant evidence. You're not conceding that?
No, Your Honor, okay. We are not conceding that. I think that that question, as I say, is kind of bound up in the discussion that comes from Ray, but I don't think that a discussion of that is necessary to the court's decision here under the principles stated in cases like Best, because it doesn't, it's not another question necessarily presented here. It's a question that is bound up in the agreed upon Ray basis, whereas I think the Frost argument is a wholly independent argument. I think both parties would appreciate the court's guidance on. So unless there are any further questions, the secretary would ask that this court find that the board is not required to consider the effects of a non-service-connected disability on a veteran's ability to engage in substantially gainful employment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, Mr. Del Rio is not asking the court to overturn any of its previous decisions, explicitly Ray or Van Hoos or Haddleston. Those cases don't speak to this issue. Those cases say that the board must consider all service-connected conditions. That's still true. That's what we're asking. But we're asking the court's guidance on whether that also includes or whether that includes conditions that are service-connected as of the date of the adjudication or conditions that were service-connected throughout the appeal period. We believe that Frost gives us guidance on how to answer that question based on the plain language 4.16. And because we're reading the plain language, we don't believe that the secretary's deference should be afforded here. We also believe that the language in the Secondary Service Connection Regulation 3.310 is similar to the language in 4.16. Both of them have this link. In Secondary Service Connection, they talk about a condition being a result of or a service-connected condition. In 4.16, it mentions unemployability or the inability to perform substantially gainful employment as a result of underlying conditions. So we have a causal link with no temporal requirements. We believe that the language ratable only further helps to reinforce the fact that there's no temporal requirements. So we would ask this court apply the logic in Frost to 4.16. In regards to the examinations in this case, a VA examiner can make observations as to someone's medical symptoms. What they can't do is then make an ultimate conclusion without a rationale. But saying that someone has trouble engaging with other people in a PTSD context is similar to saying that someone in an orthopedic context can only bend to a certain extent. We don't see why any other rationale would be required. What an examiner can't do, as we mentioned in our briefs, is opine on the ultimate issue of unemployability without first being at least having some evidence that they're competent to do so. So we think what the board should have done is looked at the underlying facts in this case, what came out of those examinations, and determined if the veteran was unemployable. They should not have rejected examinations because they didn't opine on the ultimate issue of unemployability, especially because it's unclear if those examiners were even competent to make such a call. For this reason, Your Honors, we ask that the court issue a remand requiring the board to consider the veteran's fibromyalgia prior to 2006 for the TDIU purposes. Alternatively, we ask the court issue a remand based on the secretary's concession in this case, as well as the board's improper treatment of the medical evidence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted for consideration, and the court will now come down to greet counsel.
All rise.